The U.S. pullout from the Paris Accord was expected, and with it, a chorus of critics from the environmentalist community. That would not include climate and ecological advocate Stuart Scott. He's held a contrarian view of the agreement since its inception, but not for the reasons you might think. Stuart Scott is back at home in Honolulu after a trip to the EU, and he's in our studio now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Beth Ann. I'm very glad to be here.
Now, you have been critical of the Paris Accord, and some might find that strange because you've been so involved with the environmentalist movement here and worldwide. What led to your contrarian view?
Well, I was there in Paris, and I wrote an op-ed piece after it was completed. And I'll just read you a sentence that'll answer that question perfectly. It means as much then as it does now. Developed nations forced through a sufficiently weak document that a climate catastrophe is unlikely to be avoided. Instead, they took a step way back in order to kick the can way down the road across multiple decades and election cycles, much past the point where tipping points will lead to irreversible, self-amplifying, possibly runaway conditions. In other words, it was a sham agreement just for the purpose of slapping one another on the back and saying we did good. It was a stick in the mud, and it's very hard to ratchet up ambition, as the UN speak goes, to a stick placed in the mud.
That stick, though, has been much lauded, and now there are many who are angry at the United States for its withdrawal from this agreement when you have over 195 countries who decide that this is a good thing. How do you turn that tide?
Okay, let me go back to the November of last year, where I was at the climate negotiations again that were in Marrakesh, COP22. And the day after Trump was elected president, there was a pallor that came over the negotiations. People were just stunned. And the day after that, I encountered a gentleman, part of the UN Climate Secretariat's press corps, who I've known for years, and spoke with him and asked him what their perception, what the perception of the UN was. And of course, he said it's not very, not a very good one, you know. Everyone was very depressed about, demoralized. And I said to him, well, it's going to have to get bad before it gets better. And this will make it a lot worse a lot more quickly, and perhaps there'll be a boomerang effect. And to me, that is the silver lining in Trump pulling out of a bad agreement. Now, it's not that it was a bad agreement for the U.S. It was a bad agreement for the people of Earth. It was an agreement that favored the financial and business sectors over the well-being of future humanity. That is, make money now, the future be damned, was the way that I saw the agreement. And so Trump pulling out focuses everyone else on that ratcheting up of ambition.
In the ensuing time that we've had this agreement since 2015, have you been back in touch with this UN press secretary?
Yes, I actually wrote him an email yesterday, anticipating we'd be speaking today, and asked him – well, I sent him an email from 350.org, another famous environmentalist organization, saying that we've just presented 2.5 million signatures from around the world to the UN supporting the Paris Agreement and protesting the U.S. withdrawal. And I asked him, isn't this what we spoke about in Marrakesh? And what is the view from your side of the world now? And his response, he's very busy, was one word, elated. This is the silver lining, that Trump is the perfect villain, perhaps. He's personifying the businessman who says, make money, forget about everything else. And so he is energizing the environmentalist base around the world and the commitments that other nations have made.
You say now that the withdrawal from the Paris Accord could have some of these positive effects in galvanizing everyone.
Yes.
How would you see that happening? And within the confines of the UN, given the response that you just received from this press secretary friend of yours, mm-hmm. What do you think would be a course of action that we might see coming from the UN?
Coming from the UN. The UN is just a facilitator. They try to bring the parties together. The quote-unquote ambition to do something about it is up to the parties. And I think that's now coming from the grassroots level. I think that shall we say, the world is ganging up on the United States in a very good sense. It's not about one nation and the success of one nation. It's all of us sink or swim together. This is not a zero-sum game where I can win what you lose. This is an all-of-us-win or all-of-us-lose game. So I see the UN's best strategy would be to capitalize on this, to let the United States do what they're going to do and bring everyone else along to a stronger agreement, stronger than Paris, because Paris was exceedingly weak.
When you have so many countries, 195 of them, who are, as you say, ganging up on the United States and believing that the United States is in the wrong with this, clearly they feel that this is a good thing. How do you change their minds and make them take action on a piece of work that you think isn't effective at all, given what it was supposed to do or what the hopes were at least going into it?
Well, there are a million things that can be done, and that has to be done by a million people. I think everyone who's concerned needs to find some way that they can put their shoulder to the wheel and push, whether it's through the environmental organizations that are out there and doing great work, or letters to the editor, personally downsizing one's own ecological footprint. There are a lot of things that need to be done. Where I work is the awareness, trying to disseminate the awareness that this is a much more serious problem than ocean rise in 2100. Our media, unfortunately, goes along with the pronouncements of certain leaders who I think downplay the problem. I think we have a very, very severe problem. I'm trying to get everybody aware that this is really coming at us very soon.
How do you see environmentalists coalescing around that message when, again, they too, like many of the countries that we've talked about, believe that Paris was a good start?
Well, I think the current wave of demonstrations that we're seeing is a very good thing. I said several years ago that the point at which people are coming out in the streets will know that society is finally getting it.
Hawaii just became the first state to pass legislation that makes law of parts of the accord. We heard this yesterday.
Wonderful.
To reduce greenhouse gas emissions and create a carbon farming task force. Hundreds of cities and states across the country are now in an alliance to act similarly. We saw tweets coming from Mayor Caldwell today, from the governor yesterday and today. What would you encourage all of them to consider beyond this pledge of solidarity?
Eternal vigilance. I think that's part of a quote from American history. I can't remember the full quote now, but we can't just rest on legislation and proclamations. We have to stay in there and make sure that Governor Ige lives up to the promise in that bill that he just signed into law.
And specifically, what would that mean to live up to that promise?
Well, I know when he was elected, he said that we were going to his goal was that 20% of the food supply for the islands should be grown in the islands by the year 2020. I may be getting the numbers not quite right, but then he softened that. He realized that was not doable, or not doable under the current assumptions. The current assumptions are that we have to stop. This is my personal pet peeve. We have to stop building on the best farmland on the island, Ho'opili and Koa Ridge in particular. Now, those are perhaps done deals, but if they can be reversed, I think we're sacrificing the food security of our children to those two developments.
Stuart Scott, we need to leave it there. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Stuart Scott is the executive director of the United Planet Faith and Science Initiative, which he founded. He records Climate Matters TV shows at the annual UN Climate Negotiation.
Support for today's programming comes from Bishop Museum. The original exhibit, Hulia Ano, Inspired Patterns, explores Hawaiian aesthetic traditions by examining the ano, or nature, of objects in pattern, shape, and form. Open through October 16th.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the Kapi'olani Community College Culinary Program has a couple of surprises in store for you. But first, your quiz.
A little later in the program, we'll be hearing about a new program that combines the culinary arts with jazz. So for today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a man who did something similar in his life. In his day, our mystery man was known as the singing chef. He gained local fame in the 1960s as a singer in Waikiki's international marketplace, and at the height of his musical career, he played alongside such notable performers as Don Ho, Dick Jensen, and Loyal Garner. After several years of success, he expanded his professional life into another personal passion, cooking. He opened up a lunch wagon, which was a common sight along Sand Island Access Road until his death last year. Today, we're looking for his name. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. There's a prize in it if you're first and right, and we promise we won't sing.
Aloha, this is Dr. Carl Hart from Columbia University. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Well, after years running dining and entertainment venues, John Richards became founder and director of Miami Culinary Institute at Miami-Dade College. He was hired at Kapi'olani Community College in 2015 to run their culinary programs, which are now swinging into high gear. John Richards, thanks so much for joining us.
Aloha, Noah. It's great to be here with you today.
Oh, terrific. We're catching him on site there at the Palikū Theater, where he's got a lot going on. I've got to tell you, John, let's take a look quickly at some of the initiatives going on there in the culinary program. I know I had a great time at the Leahi Concept Kitchen last week.
Wonderful. That's a great opportunity for our students there.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Happy to give you some more about that. The Leahi Concept Kitchen is an amazing partnership between the Halekulani Corporation and Kapi'olani Community College, where they've given us an opportunity to operate the restaurant in the Waikiki Park Hotel.
The former Nobu.
Previously occupied by Nobu. And Nobu moved to a new location. So we have the location for the next year and a half or so to develop the concepts that we're going to take to the Culinary Institute of the Pacific restaurant at Diamond Head that's under construction as we speak.
It's really fun to go there because there's a sign outside that says no tipping, or there's a different gratuity. I mean, the whole place runs a little bit differently because it is an educational opportunity for the students and for us, really, patrons who go there. It's a beautiful restaurant there, the former Nobu, right in the Park Hotel.
Yes, we're so proud of this. And you know, we've been working on this for a couple of months now, and it's opening up a restaurant is hard enough, but opening it up with totally inexperienced students is a whole other level of challenge. And our whole team and our students have really risen to the challenge, and we're very proud of the menu, the concept, the service that we're delivering now. And the guests of Waikiki are just in for a real treat.
Oh, and the rest of us are too, because, I mean, there are items on the menu there that there are a lot more kind of Filipino-influenced things I noticed on menus around town in general, but also some Chamorro dishes that were just great to see, John.
I'm so glad to hear that. We feel the same way.
And so that's the kind of thing you'll be moving to, the Culinary Institute of the Pacific, which, of course, is currently being built there on Montserrat on the slopes of Diamond Head, right?
Well, that's right. This has been an initiative with the University of Hawaii for 10 or 15 years. It's been a vision, and we saw the first phase of that vision come to reality this past March with the opening of Phase 1 to great fanfare and accolade and pride. It is a stunning, stunning facility that we have here in Hawaii, and I've seen many of the best in the country, and I think this is going to be the finest in the world at this moment.
What's
and our
going
job
to be,
is to... Yeah. Go ahead, Lori, sorry.
I guess I need to know what our job is. How will we be unique and attractive?
Several things. First and foremost is that in the state of Hawaii, until now, in culinary education, the highest level you could reach would be that of an associate degree in culinary arts management and baking and pastry arts. Mm-hmm. Now with this facility, we have the advanced culinary training program, which is a third and fourth year program. Previously, our students had to go to the mainland or to Asia to complete their higher education. And now for the first time, we can actually do that without having to relocate to another country. And again, it's not just taking the program here. It's really taking it in a world-class institution, really a phenomenal opportunity.
So we'll have a four-year Bachelor of Science program there in Culinary Arts. Boy, that's great. Can you compare our programs nationally and internationally? John, you're familiar with what others offer.
Well, I certainly can. Nationally, for sure. We rank among the highest in the country, and that's been said by many publications. Our culinary arts and science degree, the advanced degrees in culinary food service management, and now culinology, which is really blazing a path for students who want to do more than just cook. They want to innovate and help change the way we feed our nation. And that's kind of my lofty goal, is to engage our students in that philosophical part of food innovation. How are we going to continue to provide the food that we need in our state so that we can sustain and enrich ourselves greatly?
Oh, John, I know you've had a commitment to sustainability in your other projects, and it's exciting to think what we could do for that, for sustainability, if we just change some of our eating habits in this country. But, you know, we have received a lot of accolades here for our KCC culinary program, and I understand you've got a team going up to the American Culinary Federation Championships again.
Yes, we're so proud of this. It's really a prideful spring for us. Our culinary competition team at Kapi'olani won the state competition. This was back in February, I believe. Then we went to a regional contest where we competed against five other states and regions of the country, and we won there. And so now in early July, we go to Orlando to compete once again for the national title in the American Culinary Federation Culinary Salon. This is the Wimbledon of student competitions. It's the best in the land and the most prestigious, and our students are just phenomenal.
It's rare to win twice or even to go twice.
Mm-hmm. It is rare, and we did win that contest back in 2008, I believe. I was not here. I was in a competing team that did not take the title that year from Miami. And it's great to be here with this team now because we plan to take the national title.
All right. Well, you're doing a little bit of fundraising to get there. And so that's what takes you to Palikou right now, right? We've got about a minute left to talk about Culinaire, John.
Thank you so much. Culinaire is a music, cooking, dance, story, magic, and chocolate story. It's a culinary concert on stage. Really wonderful production. And the reason we're doing this is to create awareness for our culinary programs throughout the state, and more particularly to raise sponsoring funds to help our culinary competition team with the expenses to go to Orlando. It's a very expensive undertaking, and we have the opportunity to raise some of the money by putting on a great show where some of our culinary students and team members are actually a part of the show.
That's terrific. And this is part of sort of a marketing effort on the part of the culinary school, right?
It is. Mm-hmm. Culinary is designed to be a marketing vehicle, as I said, to help spread awareness of the many, many things that we're doing in culinary arts that are on the front edge of the cutting edge of culinary in the United States. It's really amazing.
And this, okay, geez, the culinary, kind of a culinary musical coming up. It's called Culinaire at Polycou Theater this coming Saturday. The time of the program,
this
John?
Saturday. It starts at 7:30 Saturday at Polycou Theater.
Thank you so much, John Richards. Yeah, I know you've got to get back to the rehearsal and the like. Thank you for your time this morning. You have to swing by and
it's
have a great meal at Leahy Concept Kitchen as soon as possible. John Richards is the Dean of Hospitality, Business, and Legal Academic Programs at Kapi'olani Community College. Find out more about KCC's culinary initiatives and some dining opportunities you might want to take part in. Check it out on the Conversation Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from Mattson, in appreciation of HPR's local public affairs programming. Since 1882, working to support Hawaii's economy and communities. Mattson.com.
A widening bribery and sex scandal in the Navy has Hawaii connections. CivilBeat.org reporter Kirsten Downey joins us now with today's reality check. Hi there, Kirsten.
Aloha. How are you, Beth Ann?
Well, it seems a lot better than some of the folks in this scandal. I mean, this sounds like a plot from 5-0. Who's involved and how did this scandal crack?
Well, we don't know all the history of it, and it's all still coming to light. But this is a widening and broadening scandal, and some people think that up to 200 people are under scrutiny right now, including 30 admirals, in a case that involved a Malaysian entrepreneur named Leonard Francis, who was called Fat Leonard. He was a big guy, and they called him Fat Leonard, and he really knew how to woo people and entice him to give him information. So what it's turned out is that dozens of naval officers have been implicated in this, and they traded information on troop movements and ship movements in exchange for luxury vacations, for fine dining, expensive wine, and visits with prostitutes.
So who are some of these people involved?
One of the ones who was just recently convicted was David Capon, who was a Hawaii an Oahu resident who pled guilty yesterday to lying about his relationship with Fat Leonard. And he pled guilty in the U.S. District Court in Honolulu yesterday. The cases are being prosecuted by the U.S. Justice Department, mainly out of Southern California. But as the investigation proceeds, we're seeing more of these cases also turn up in federal court here in Hawaii. Of course, that makes a lot of sense because the Seventh Fleet, which was the locus of the corruption activity, is part of the Hawaii-based Pacific Command.
So at this point, what was the relationship with Fat Leonard that led to all of this? I mean, you've sort of intimated a little bit, but what did Capon do?
Well, it's not clear exactly, and his plea agreement was not made public. A lot of this is secret information, which is part of the reason that the extent of the investigation is only slowly coming to light. But he is alleged to have accepted undisclosed gifts from Fat Leonard over a long-term relationship. It came. His particular case came to light when he went to work after he left the military. He became deputy chief of staff for special operations for the entire Pacific Command in Honolulu. He had to do a regular security clearance update in early 2005, and he failed to disclose that he knew Fat Leonard. On the security clearance documents, you were supposed to cite any foreign nationals that you knew and that you'd had business with. Knowing that this investigation was underway and that it would hurt his reputation and his career to be associated with it, David Capon chose not to include the contacts with Fat Leonard.
We've got to go in just a second, but was he sentenced? And if so, what happened?
He'll be sentenced on September 11th. He faces up to 5 years in prison and a $250,000 fine.
Pretty hefty, but some would say maybe not hefty enough considering what may have happened, and we don't know the full story yet, but thank you very much for bringing us this part of it.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you. Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat, today featuring reporter Kirsten Downey. You've often been told that you need to write or call your elected officials, write testimony, and show up at the legislature. In short, get involved in the process of government. But the popular idea that greater citizen participation makes government better may need something more. Two senior fellows at the Brookings Institution say your participation can be effective only when it's augmented by the work done by institutions. Our contributing editor Neil Milner joins us now for The Long View. Hey there.
Hi.
Now, a lot of people may be bristling at the idea or even just the notion that more citizen participation is not necessarily a good thing. In fact, that it could be even problematic, as these two researchers suggest, and that that's not the solution to better government. What do you tell them?
Well, if they bristle, they haven't been paying much attention, and they're still captivated by the folk theory of democracy myth that we've talked about before. Look, for 25 years at least, all kinds of research has shown that the assumptions we make about voting and about people's interest in politics is not only wrong, but is essentially counter to the way we're wired. And some of this research is really based on path-breaking Nobel Prize-winning studies of political psychology. We don't have to go into those now. But that's part of what's going on here, that there isn't this reliance on individual participation and the rationality of the voter and the voter's interest in politics, which has been one thread of political reform for many years, is just that, one thread. It hasn't worked very well. There's always been another thread in our democracy that was very important in the Founding Fathers, and that is the preservation of and making institutions what they call intermediary strong. And that's what they say needs more emphasis.
For people who think institutions stronger when already they're looking at it with a fisheye, What's the argument that says that these institutions, these intermediaries, in fact, work better in the public interest than people who simply rise up, come together, as we've been seeing for the past several months?
Well, here's the deal. It's understandable that you would look at this with a fisheye, and certainly the argument that the Brookings people make is based to some extent on projecting out. But here is the argument, basically. We have institutions that have been limited over the years in the name of reform, and that we've gone too far in that direction, so that Congress is full of extremists because political parties don't have as much power to mitigate the ideologies anymore. We elect people to the presidency who get the nomination, like Donald Trump, because we've now relied on the direct primaries more than we have before. It's unimaginable that if you did the old kind of nomination process that someone like Trump would get the nominee. In the name of giving people more access, we've also increasing the opportunity for certain kinds of people to give more money. It's more of a complex argument, but the important thing to understand for them, bottom line, is to take into consideration the possibility that the kinds of directions we've used for reform, the emphasis on transparency, the emphasis on taking power away from political parties and putting them in the hands of individuals. All the things that sound really good, and in fact, we're really good. We may have reached the point where we have to start thinking about strengthening these intermediaries, two kinds of intermediaries. Political intermediaries, professionals, and substantive intermediaries. That is, get away from this distrust of elite and understand the role that expertise needs to play because, in fact, experts mitigate some of these problems.
And yet they're also sort of pointing fingers at some of the so-called experts, some of these citizen good government groups that we traditionally look at as being out there in the public's interest to make that position known, thinking about the League of Women Voters and Common Cause. Why point fingers at them, too?
Because they've been, to some extent, victimized by and perpetuate the kind of emphasis on transparency and the emphasis on the power of voting. Now, I want to be very careful here. These two guys don't say these are unimportant. They say they've gone too far and we have to focus on other things. The good government groups are not experts in the sense that they're interested in experts. They're saying you got to bring professionals back into it. Take global warming, for example. Global warming requires a level of knowledge that is quite complex. It requires professional notions and requires expertise. Global warming, the climate change issue is totally on the other side of the spectrum now. It's essentially a political issue. With mostly ideology, not very much concern about scientific information, and no legitimate intermediary organizations that can deal with it. Congress is a disaster on this one because it's the upshot of what's happened to Congress over time.
If, in fact, we go back to some of our previous conversations about how we are hardwired to look for agreement, what makes it any better for these professionals to act in the public interest and not also be seeking agreement?
Well, no, it's not. In fact, their advantage is they're seeking agreements. What they argue is that one of the things that professionals can bring to this thing, they bring two things. They bring real expertise. And this is an interesting argument, people who really have to make the policy and have to do so in a kind of non-political, non-partisan manner will reach out to others and will bring in more opinions. They say one of the things that's happened now is that special interest groups of all kinds have undue influence in the political process. If you give more control to these mitigating institutions or these mitigating people, they're more likely to build kinds of coalitions and take into considerations and even bring out hidden interests. Look, I'm not ready to defend this thing as biblical, but I think that it's worth considering, and that's where they end, that you need to consider this other half of the equation.
So what I hear you saying is that some of these special interest groups have become so fragmented that they don't really have the opportunity to build a broader coalition in the way that perhaps a professional might.
I would put it this way. There is very little incentive and all kinds of disincentives to build those kind of coalitions in today's politics. And so politics, if you think about it, one of the difficulties that the Democratic Party has now is to build coalitions of different kinds of groups. So it isn't just that they don't have it isn't just that they don't want to. It's very hard to do so. And so one of the reason is that, say, political party officials, people who are involved in things or subject matter experts have sort of disappeared from the scene. The distrust of elites and the belief in the power of the people, both of which are kind of the essence of populism, not just Trump populism. They're not just talking about Trump populism, but just the essence general of this emphasis.
And it's worth emphasizing that this paper by Jonathan Rauch and Benjamin Wittes was done before.
Well, the paper may have not been done before it, but they've been writing about it.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
right. Rauch has written about this before. He's been concerned. It doesn't take much to see that one of the problems over the past umpteen years has been gridlock and has been a kind of ideological overload and not getting anything done and a sort of extreme polarization. And so he's been writing about how you act as intermediaries to reduce
I guess
that.
My point is this isn't in response
oh,
to
no,
Trump
Oh, no, it's not
populism.
In response
It's
to
something
it.
That they've been doing for a while.
Yeah.
And we're going to post the paper, which is called More Professionalism, Less Populism, How Voting Makes Us Stupid.
Very
and what
readable
to do
paper.
About. Very readable. Came out last week, and we'll have it posted for you on our website.
There'll be a test on it next time I'm on.
Okay. Fair deal. Thank you, Neil.
Sure.
And Neil Milner taught political science at Manoa for 40 years and is the contributing editor of our biweekly segment, The Long View.
Aloha. I'm Anders Osborne from New Orleans, Louisiana. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you to give us the name of the so-called singing chef, a prominent local singer who also became a successful food vendor. All right, he graduated from Kailua High School in 1958, quickly achieved success as a singer. His best-known composition, He Aloha Mele. All right, it's coming into focus here. By the mid-1960s, he was heading his own show at Waikiki's International Marketplace, playing with Don Ho, Dick Jensen. In the 1970s, he decided to pursue another passion, cooking. He opened Iva's Hawaiian Grinds Lunch Truck, was a fixture along Sand Island Access Road until Iva Kinimaka's death last summer. He was 76 years old. Iva Kinimaka was the name we were looking for today.
And Penny Higa called us from IA. I knew the answer, and Bill B. will be receiving the prize. That's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, and you just might hear it on a future show.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, partnering with parents and educators in Hawaii to strengthen the connection between school and home with tools to help monitor students' gains. Achieve3000.com.
Lisa Yamada Son is editorial director for Nella Media Group. She's the founder and editor of Flux Magazine. It's a lifestyle periodical intent on capturing what is unique and local about Hawaii. Welcome here, Lisa.
Thanks for having me, Noi.
It's great to see you. I love the themes you choose for your issues. You know, the good life, I loved the article you had, Cuba Libre. The companions issue is so great. You went into all kinds of companions. And we think about that, the pets in our lives, the older
people. The cowboys and their horses.
Yes, that's right. That was so great. You did school spirit. And what's the latest issue?
Our latest issue is Sacred Spaces. And it's part of our complete redesign of Flux Magazine. And it's really about personal sacred spaces, natural landscape sacred spaces. Kind of what we try to do with the themes of the issue is explore, far and wide about each theme and really dig deep and try to unpack everything and everything we can about each particular theme.
It's so surprising where you end up going with that. And by the way, I will say you write some of the most ripping editor's notes
thanks.
In town. Really. And this one for the Sacred Spaces edition, mm-hmm. really dug down deep. It's exciting what Flux is into these days. I mean, I see you so active around town, of course, in so many ways. And you've been going out of the state as well.
We have. We've been traveling quite a bit.
Uh-huh. The last few years.
The last few years, yeah. This is our fourth year that we've represented Hawaii to the world. We started in 2014 to launch the national distribution of Flux, and we started with an event in New York City. And since then, we've done one also in Los Angeles, and this year we've done a pop-up shop in Sydney. This is actually our third year that we've done this pop-up shop concept. The first year was in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and then in Venice in Los Angeles.
I know these great hip locations. Some of the best that Hawaii produces. And this is not your typical Hawaii Tourism Association road show. It's really a look at a certain aspect, a certain hip segment of Honolulu.
It really is about promoting the innovation that's happening in Hawaii. And the name of Flux, you know, it was always meant to imply change. You know, there's this idea or notion of Hawaii that things never change here. It's go with the flow, it's, you know, slow. But, you know, things are always moving in Hawaii. You know, whether they're moving forward or backward is another thing. But things are always happening here. And with the events, it was really just to showcase all that incredible, you know, things that are happening in design,
Exactly. Art,
with food, with music. So the event is to really just showcase that innovation.
It's fun. It really is. And it seems to target maybe a millennial audience.
Kind of. I mean, the people that have come into the shop and come into our events, they range. I mean, they're even with the magazine, our readers and our interests are from all walks of life. You know, we have people in high school that will contact us, as well as, you know, people in their 70s that will write us hand letters, which is always nice to receive.
We've got some great athletic photographs of Mark Cunningham, for example, of these issues. You took Martin and MacArthur with you. You took Matt Bruning, an incredible West Side fashion designer. Terrific that you found him and took him with you. Jana Lamb, Leather Soul. I mean, these are some of the really hot and unique local products.
Yeah, and what was unique this year is we did special collaboration products with a handful of the vendors, about half a dozen of them, and we worked together to create an exclusive product for Flux, to really just tell another unique story and add another layer of storytelling. And, you know, what we do as a magazine is to tell stories, and that's what we're really proud of. But we want to, you know, extend on that. And so the creating product together is just another extension of how we tell stories. And it's bringing the stories to life so people can read about Matt and read about Jana and in the magazine. Mm-hmm. And then come into the shop and experience them in real life. So we want to tell stories, and we want to provide, you know, these experiences where people can literally feel Hawaii. I mean, people walked into our Sydney shop and they would be like, oh my gosh, feels like we're in Hawaii, you know, and they just want to hang out in the shop all day. We have music going, we have it kind of smells like Hawaii with their skincare line, Hawaiian Bath and Body. So, you know, and, you know, we tell people aloha, you know, and so we really want to just showcase, you know, the aloha spirit and what's, you know, bright and beautiful about our islands.
And happening now. I mean, a lot of people have kind of a passe image of Hawaii, I must say. Well, what did the folks in Sydney like?
Yeah, so it's funny you say it, but we are what's happening now. And what we like to say is we're the current of Hawaii, and the people that we bring with us are the current of Hawaii. And what I mean when I say that is we are what's happening now and the modern Hawaii, but also we're the ones that are making the waves. We're not just going with the flow. We are the current. You know, we are defining the culture here and you know, kind of the conversation here. Mm-hmm. But people, you know, people when they came in had just incredible intense memories of Hawaii. Oh. I've never experienced so much love for the islands as I have when I was in Sydney. You know, this one woman came in, she has been coming to Hawaii since, you know, for the last 20 years, maybe longer. And she said whenever she touches down here and sees Diamond Head, she cries. And she started welling up, you know, right there in our shop. And so people have it's incredible to see how much people connect with Hawaii, and it's the culture, it's the people, you know, it's just the feeling of being here. Interestingly enough, you know, probably one of the best selling or most asked about item were Honolulu Cookie Company. Shout out to our cookie cookie guys. People just have such nostalgic memories of those shortbreads, and it's they can't get it. You know, it costs more in shipping to ship the cookies there than it actually is to buy the cookies themselves. So
good for them. Yeah. I mean, you had Salvage Public there, and I love those guys. Of course, Sig Zane and some of his people. Stephen Keen, is it?
So Stephen Keen is a local printmaker here. He does these wonderful woodblock prints of waves. Sometimes he colors them in with this blue. So he actually came up with us, and the Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism, they sponsored our programming. So we were, with their support, we were able to bring actual artisans. So Stephen Keen came and did printmaking demos. Two designers from Sig Zane came and did a talk story. We had musicians, Kimmy Miner and Isaac.
Oh, great.
So it was, you know, it's just really wonderful to have. And, you know, that's what I mean when I say they feel Hawaii, because we have I think we had about 15 people from Hawaii that we brought with us. So
now this is the Hawaii I want to see today. Where might you go next?
We're not sure.
Not sure.
Maybe back to Sydney. We'll see. Sydney's big.
And what was your impression of Sydney?
Sydney was great. Lot of toast, lot of eggs. You know, I think the biggest takeaway is how special Hawaii is and how diverse Hawaii is. And I think, you know, if anyone is from Sydney is listening, they could maybe take a page from Hawaii's book and incorporate some of the diversity there, because some of it seems a little disparate between, you know, Aboriginal cultures and, you know, Australian, you know, just the Australian culture. So I think the diversity, you know, they could take a page from Hawaii's book.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, we're still working on that, too.
We are, yes.
City of 5 million, boy, they're way ahead of us.
Yeah.
Sounds like a great trip, Lisa.
It was.
Oh, thank you so much for sharing a little bit of that with us. We'd love to connect you with Flux Magazine online or in the stores. You can find some links to that on the Conversation Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from Honolulu Waldorf School on Oahu and Haleakala Waldorf School on Maui, serving Hawaii's families from infancy with parent-child programs through high school, now accepting applications at both schools.
There are so many things going on throughout this state. It's a good thing Morning Edition host and my colleague Derek Malama comes in to tell us what's going on. What do you got for us, Derek?
Okay, tomorrow, you may not know this, but it's a World Oceans Day around the world. And also on the Big Island, they'll be celebrating it at Hapuna Beach State Recreation Area. This year's theme is Our Oceans, Our Future. You can learn about Hawaii's incredible ocean resources and how to protect them. There's a speed beach cleanup from 8 to 9 a.m. and booths with exhibits and activities. This is happening in the South Pavilion of Hapuna Beach tomorrow from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Gee, it sounds great for tourists as well.
Yeah,
it's a good one,
everybody
Derek.
Can
Thank you.
Go out there.
Mm-hmm. And we're heading maybe... People might want to head out to the west side of Oahu for a little something.
Right. You can learn about the use of plants in Hawaii that have healing qualities. There is a lecture tomorrow at the Waianae Public Library. Dr. Susanna Reed is a naturopathic physician and master gardener, and she'll demonstrate how to plant these Hawaiian plants that have healing qualities, 10:30 a.m. tomorrow at the Waianae Public Library.
Yay! Ah. And, I love it because you bring us things that are in the near future. We don't have time to forget
tomorrow.
About this.
It's tomorrow.
Yes, this Hawaii Symphony Orchestra performance. So glad you've got this.
Yeah, that kind of took me by surprise. They're going to Pearl City tomorrow for a free concert. This is a family-friendly concert conducted by renowned conductor Naoto Otomo. And this program is filled with music from Strauss to Ravel to Mozart. It's taking place in the Pearl City Cultural Center, and that's at the top of Waimano Home Road at 7:30. I have been there.
Yeah, it's a beautiful venue,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it is.
It's
really nice.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And the music's going to sound great. And the Hawaii Symphony's heading out to Pearl City. Yay!
Yeah, going up the hill there. This is a free concert tomorrow at 7:30 at Pearl City Cultural Center.
Oh, thank you so much, Derek. It's been great to hear from you and get to share with these people some ideas that you might like to take part in Under the Radar.
Hawaii Public Radio has relocated its Maui transmitters to the summit of Haleakala. This location provides better access and more reliable facilities and will allow us to reach more listeners once the project is completed, sometime before the end of June. During the transition period, we are operating at reduced power as we wait for new components to be fabricated and shipped to the transmitter site. Listeners on Maui and the west side of the Big Island may experience a noisy or non-existent signal depending on their location. We apologize for this inconvenience. Please check our website for any updates on the status of this project.
And we're coming up to the top of the hour, so that's going to do it for me and for Noe. Up tomorrow on Town Square, hemp is happening. We'll look at how it's happening here.
That sounds great, Beth Ann. And we'd like to hear from you, too. You can call our talkback line, leave us your comments there. Here's the number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR.
Our past shows and lots of great programs are on the station's archive. For our shows, look on The Conversation page. There are links to guests and all kinds of good things. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Noe Tanigawa.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Join me tomorrow for Town Square.